Welcome to Inside the Hut. I'm your host, Brooke Pollock, founder of Hut Capital. Inside the Hut is a podcast that talks with leading blockchain venture capital investors to dive deep into their firm, strategy, and approach to a complex space at the forefront of innovation. You can find this and other episodes on Spotify and other podcast players, or on our website at www.hutcapital.com. The content of each episode of Inside the Hut is for informational purposes only and should not be taken as legal, business, tax, or investment advice, or be used to evaluate any investment or security and is not directed at any investors or potential investors in any Hut Capital fund. Please note that Hut Capital and its affiliates may also maintain or be considering investments in or related to the companies, funds, assets, or strategies discussed in the podcast. For more details, including a link to our investments and related disclosures, please see www.hutcapital.com. Welcome to this week's episode of Inside the Hut with your host, Brooke Pollock. Really excited to have an interesting conversation this week with our guests, Kenny Rowe and Nick Simmons. Kenny and Nick are the co-summoners of Octu Ventures, a member-led venture DAO focused on the Urbit ecosystem. So thank you for joining us, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Awesome. So to get started, we'd love to just hear about your own backgrounds. Just introduce yourselves, a little more about yourself and how you got to where you are today with Octu.
So my name is Kenny Rowe, and I got started with crypto in 2015 with MakerDAO, kind of the early founding team there. Kind of also wanted to get into stablecoins, and medium of exchange was really where my interest was. So I've always been interested in DeFi, these types of tools for making it easier to transact online. I got introduced into Urbit also through MakerDAO in 2017, 2018, somewhere around there. Thought it was a really interesting project and kind of put it on the back burner. Came back to it again in 2019 is when I joined Talon. And that's where I met Nick. And we've been thinking about all kinds of different ways to use Urbit and play with it in the meantime. That's a little bit about me.
My background is in, among other things, nonprofit administration, bylaw design, basically like how to make nonprofits and foundations run better. So I got pulled into the Urbit ecosystem around 2019 when a mutual friend of myself and the Talon executives at the time reached out to me because they were looking at launching the Urbit Foundation. And so I came in to consult on that and really got sucked into the ecosystem, really realized that it was the solution to a lot of things I've been thinking about for a while, and stayed on at Talon for 3 years. I was the head of community there, and then later I was the head of special ops, which involves stuff like partnerships, some macro research, think about where the ecosystem was going. I left about a year ago, and Kenny and I had quite a few conversations around, hey, how will this ecosystem develop? What does, say, early stage investing look like there? What's the optimal form factor for that? And so when he came to me again about a year ago with the news that Hydra was interested, we took it and we've been off the races ever since. It definitely took a minute to ideate correctly around, hey, what's our thesis? Who are the key people that we need to get in here? And where's our focus? We're launching presently. It's been a great ride so far.
So I guess you guys met at Talon, which I guess is a fair representation to say they're kind of one of the OG Urbit-related startups.
Yeah, they pretty much launched the protocol. And then about 2.5 years ago, the Urbit Foundation spun out of them. And now the Urbit Foundation handles essentially core development and community partnerships, that sort of thing. And then Talon is more of a pure product company now. They ship the iOS app, for example, that people use to interact with Urbit.
So we'll get more into Urbit, more into the venture DAO side of things and why you guys chose that structure versus a traditional fund. But just to start, what is Octu Ventures? What's the focus? What's the strategy? Maybe you can tell us a little more about the DAO and the strategy you have.
So Octu is a venture DAO, is the common name of this. And some of the predecessors for this kind of organization are things like Metacartel Ventures, the Lao, even things sort of like Tribute Labs with all of their various investment DAOs. The structure here, though, is from a legal perspective, it's a member-led LLC. All the members are actual members of a legal entity. But we coordinate online. We use traditional crypto rails to manage our treasury. We vote to make decisions. And so in that sense, we are a DAO in the decentralized or distributed sense. We organize online. We're spread out all over across the world, and we're focused on a particular area in order to deploy capital.
What is the primary goal of the DAO?
primary goal of the DAO is to get into seed stage companies that are building in the Urbit ecosystem. And specifically, what we bring to the table as this structure here is we've got members that have huge range of experience. And so we can evaluate these opportunities, and then we can source these opportunities locally as a member-driven organization. We just think that that's a fantastic way to go about finding the real opportunity.
We'll get into more of, from your perspective, how it's different operating a DAO, but let's say you're a founder building something in the Urbit ecosystem. Is it different taking capital and working with a venture DAO like Octu versus any kind of more traditional looking venture fund?
I think so. And I think there's probably a couple ways in which it's different. We do have a little bit of a slower process, but that's mostly just because we have a lot of people that need to get up on board. But it's not too bad in the sense of working with us. But we also bring things that maybe wouldn't come out of a traditional GP, LP, traditional fund. So we can do things like if we have a particular opportunity where there's a real strong founding team, but they don't have certain maybe technical experience. We've got a lot of members with deep understanding of how Urbit works, the programming languages, all of the sort of ins and outs. And we can bring that to that startup in order to help them get either that MVP out the door or whatever particular help they need in order to actually make it successful. Plus, we're just so well connected in this ecosystem that we can also make connections where, let's say, they need some design help or integration with some other product. Urbit does tend to lend itself to be composable, but you do need to maybe know some things ahead of time, that sort of thing. So we can bring in along connections, all these kinds of things where a founder might need a little additional extra support in a nascent ecosystem that we can provide. That's one of the core benefits of the structure that we've got.
One little example of this right now is that we have several investments or potential investments or incubations that are starting to think about how the data that interactions in a given, say, Urbit protocol for a given use case create reputation identity data. And so we're starting to kind of be a hosting venue for these conversations around, okay, if I'm producing this data, how can we all collaborate here to get the flywheel going? Because we see the Urbit ID and reputation as one of the things that's, it's maybe not a primary focus right now, but it's on the horizon in terms of a benefit that is really unique to this ecosystem in terms of the way that you can produce this data and then you can ZKify it. It can be relatively pseudonymous or anonymous, but it can allow for greater fidelity of who you're dealing with, the trust relationships, and some of the unique products you can build on top of that.
Let's dig more into that, more on the Urbit side of things and what it is and why you guys are excited about investing in this space. But just to start, the 10-foot view or the 100-foot view, whatever the terminology is, for those who are less familiar with Urbit, maybe you can just kind of give a quick overview of what it is in the first place.
Urbit is essentially three constituent parts that all fit together. There's Urbit OS, which is a purely deterministic functional virtual machine. So it's a full computational stack that's been rewritten from scratch. And it could run on metal. There is actually an interesting project, Knock FPGA, to make it do that eventually. But right now it runs as a virtual machine on top of basically any Linux environment. It's designed to be extremely simple and extremely durable and long lasting. The Knock instruction set, you could think of as an analog in some ways to a kernel if it's on a t-shirt, whereas the Linux kernel at this point is multi-million lines of code or more. The intention is to allow for development to be frozen, something called Kelvin versioning. Look it up. We won't digress too far there. But the idea is that this can be a frozen technical primitive that people can build on that doesn't change. And then this obviates the need to have large technical bureaucracies to run or maintain in a technical sense. This allows a whole bunch of downstream effects that we can get into. But the key thing here is that Urbit is designed to be a network of personal servers that allow anyone, whether they're an individual, technical or not, or whether they're the maintainer of infrastructural node, to serve up content to a network in a very decentralized way without needing to constantly twiddle with the knobs on server architecture, which is definitely how it works right now. The second part of the Urbit stack is Urbit ID. So this is actually a fun fact. I think this was the first or second ever implementation of ERC-721 standard. So these are NFTs on the Ethereum blockchain. Every node in the Urbit network, and we'll get to a little bit of how the network architecture works in a second, it has one of these ERC-721 identifiers. There are planets, which are the ordinary user identities. There's about 4 billion of those. And then there's about 65,000 stars, which are more like ISPs or community hubs. And they perform packet routing and peer discovery functions for the planet identities. And then there are 256 galaxies. And so the galaxies are key sources of truth for, say, major software updates. They also form something called the Galactic Senate, which is essentially a DAO that decides on major network changes. The only big one that's gone through so far has been the height of DeFi summer. The Ethereum fees to, say, boot a planet up reached about like $350, which is obviously a bit of a barrier. And so there was an internal engineering effort at Talon to make a layer two rollup solution. And so that required a vote of all the galaxies to say, okay, we're going to recognize these layer two identities, which of course was successful. The Galactic Senate runs the network. It's kind of like if you tokenize, you know, an IPv8 root node, which is kind of a wild concept. And so that consists of a third part of the Urbit stack, which is the networking protocol, AIMS. This is a completely new networking protocol that is designed to route around damage. So every star is hosted by a galaxy, a given one, and every planet is hosted by a star. And in both these cases, you have to be accepted by, respectively, a star or galaxy, but you can also leave and find a new sponsor whenever you want. And so if a star goes offline and stops routing packets, you as a planet simply go find a new sponsor. Ditto, if a galaxy goes offline, you as a star have 255 other galaxies, theoretically, to go and find a sponsor from. Combined with the fact that it's not your keys, not your identity, and you actually have your identity as a bearer asset, this allows for a large degree of permissionless interaction on the protocol level between known entities, but there aren't these same centralized shelling points that we see, for example, in Web 2, where you have to dial into a central server and your credentials live in a central server and they're essentially aligned in the database and all the interactions happen on that central server and you're essentially just always a client.
A lot to take in there. So if I want to utilize Urbit, I guess what I run the software, maybe I need to purchase an Urbit ID and a personal server. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the Urbit ID, there's one other anonymous identity. These are called comets, which doesn't require any sort of interaction with a blockchain. But if you want one of these smaller, they come in human readable names. My name, for example, is SickDev Pilna. That's just a way to identify me on the network. Something that I can remember. We end up remembering some of these things. It's kind of like a phone number, something like that. There are longer names that don't require any sort of registration or ownership, but they still have their own private keys. So they can still interact on the network. You can just think of them as either disposable identities or anonymous identities. So there is less barrier to entry. And the options that you have here, you either can delegate somebody else to run your Urbit for you, but you remain in control of the private keys. So in this way, you remain control over that data at all times, but somebody else can run it for you. There's a number of hosting providers. Talon is an example of this. Red Horizon is another one. And they offer just a really clean, easy onboarding experience. One click email kind of thing that people are very familiar with. There's also hardware boxes you can buy. One company called Native Planet actually will ship you a really cool computer with a nice case on it that's dedicated to running one of these things. You turn it on, it's very much almost like a modem that you would have in your closet or something like that. And it pops up a little website. Oh, and now I'm online. But you do have to get one of these identities first, and you can get them on OpenSea or any number of NFT platforms, that kind of thing, in a very sort of traditional NFT buying experience, that sort of thing. Once you have one of these IDs, you can hook it up to this box. And the other thing you can do is run it with your own computer, with your own private server anywhere in the world that's running Linux. So those are kind of the three options that you can do in terms of like how you actually get up and running on the network, from very easy all the way to I'm going to control everything about this experience.
Okay, makes sense. Yeah, so I guess you don't have to necessarily buy your own box. You retain the keys to your private data, even if it's hosted elsewhere, which is really cool.
That's right.
In terms of like why Urbit is fundamentally interesting, clearly the ability to own all of your data and have the private key to it and retain that versus that all being seen by third parties and ISPs and them knowing everything you're doing and every centralized app out there having all your data is really interesting. Functionally, can you do anything running Urbit that you would do normally on your computer in terms of running different types of apps and software, and it just protects everything for you? Or are there limitations in terms of what you can do on Urbit? If you're an app developer, do you have to build something specifically to be used on Urbit, or can I run basically anything on Urbit that I would otherwise run? It just happens in the background.
So it is a new stack. So there is a bit of a learning curve, but it's designed to be simple. This does not necessarily mean easy, but it is simple. But there are other projects trying to make this more accessible to developers and using languages that are more familiar, that sort of thing. It is a computer. It can run any sort of software in terms of that you could write for it specifically. Most of the time right now, all of the applications are designed specifically to basically run Urbit, and you kind of have a little landscape web interface that you can click on and do different things. And there's something like an app store where you can go and find new applications and that sort of thing. You can think about it like a personal server. And what do servers do? They make content available to other people on the web. So you have these kind of two modalities. You can think about logging in to your personal server where you have your apps and your data, your connections. You log in and it's private. But you can also have public information. So you can host a blog, for example. You can host a personal website. You can host a DeFi front end, for example. So there's really two ways you can use Urbit: as a public thing for publishing content or even publishing applications that are public, or use some sort of ID primitive. Either you could use ENS, for example, or just a web server. And we do see both of these ways of doing things. And we expect that there'll probably be many other ways in which you could leverage the application of this personal server.
That's really cool. Before we keep going around Urbit and maybe go a little more to your thesis around why it's interesting, just come back to the Urbit Foundation really quick that you were talking earlier about, Nick. You know, in the blockchain space, often blockchains will have this separate legal entity as a foundation. Maybe they manage a treasury, maybe they give grants and do a lot of community development and things like that. So it's interesting to see that Urbit, which is not a blockchain, also has a foundation. I think it started maybe 5 years ago. Can you just get a little more color on what that is and why it came into existence?
So the foundation came into existence to do the same functions that you mentioned, which is to do community development and then to fund the core protocol developers. So Urbit's not a blockchain, but it does have this address space. So the usually for investment or speculation or long-term stake in the network purposes, we're talking about stars and galaxies. But of course, galaxies come nested with their complement of stars originally, and then down onto stars come nested with their amount of planets. Of course, you can migrate them away, but generally when we're talking about early investors who invest in address space, they're holding a virgin block of a galaxy with all of its stars and then all of its planets. So it's kind of a package deal. But the foundation that basically exists to fund core development. For example, there's a couple of large technical projects that are going on right now. One is called NewMars, which is an updated runtime, which will be much faster. And the other one is a slate of AIMS network protocol improvements that will make the network both faster and allow each Urbit node to have a lot more connections to other nodes simultaneously. The foundation also runs Assembly, which is the annual Urbit conference, and a lot of other community efforts, partnerships, stuff like that. There's a partnership with NIR, and there's some others that I've heard are in the works. You could think of it like a crypto foundation or, say, a Linux foundation or some of these older protocol foundation models.
One interesting thing there is the Senate or these galaxies, they do have direct control over the board of this foundation as well. So there is a point in which the network and the cryptographic assets do tie into a legal entity as well, which is interesting.
Oh, very interesting. The network effectively can control what happens with the foundation. Is that accurate?
They can put members on the board. And then the board, in the traditional legal sense, can hire and fire the executive director of the foundation.
So Octu, you guys solely invest around this Urbit ecosystem. Help us understand, why is that something that you guys think is exciting? Maybe talk to the thesis. Help us understand why you guys are excited about investing in this space.
I guess I'll start a little bit with the thesis that there's a lot of different things you can do with Urbit. Some of them are definitely venture investable. Some of them are definitely not. We do think that Urbit is a great platform to build little apps or little lifestyle businesses. And obviously, that's not going to have the same investment prospects. But we are interested, and we'll get into this in a bit, in funding people that build the tooling layer that allows that to happen at a wider scale and to offer some unique product differentiation that maybe you can't get with Web2 or even some other blockchain avenues there. Fundamentally, Urbit allows you to coordinate people and resources in new ways on a computer network. It's really that simple. In many cases, it allows you to, again, root around blockages or root around coordination inefficiencies that so far have prevented things from happening that people want to build on the internet for either personal or technical or, in this case, commercial use cases. When you look at the client-server model that we currently exist in, let's take the example of something like eBay. So eBay is a pretty bog-standard e-commerce platform client-server business model. So first of all, everyone's eBay identity just lives on eBay. They had to spin up their own bespoke identity solution, and your identity there as a buyer or seller is aligned in the database. They have to verify that your ID and your credit card is genuine when you register a new account. All the marketplace transactions on eBay take place on eBay servers. If you wanted to compete with eBay as a startup based on purely product differentiation, how good is the experience for the customer? There's a whole bunch of obstacles in your way. For example, there's GDPR, which basically regulates how you're safeguarding customer data, who your customers are, what their interactions are, everything they do that you have custody over, because it's all in this client-server model, and it's all on a server farm somewhere. The Urbit difference is that if you can have a local client that interacts with a marketplace with a headless protocol, and you have ID that proves who you are, where you've been, you know, in a pseudonymized ZKified way, then startups can start to compete with platform economies like eBay without having to necessarily jump through these same GDPR hoops, without needing to spin up the server farms, hire the SREs, the site reliability engineers, to run them, and without having to make these same decisions around onboarding churn versus this is a scammer, because people have their own keys to their own ID and they've been producing their own verified reputation the whole time. That's one example of a way in which there could be unlocking of commercial potential or product potential that the current client server architecture just doesn't really allow. So we're very interested in businesses that Urbit can make possible in that general realm.
From my perspective, coming more from the blockchain crypto landscape, it sounds like a lot of parallels in terms of being a new computing platform that folks can build on. It sounds like Urbit's ecosystem is still in the very early stages in terms of, let's say, the infrastructure phase, maybe versus the application phase. You need a lot of that infrastructure and tooling for people to actually build real things. And that kind of needs to be in place first, at least to do that at scale. Are you guys primarily investing in infrastructure and tooling around the Urbit ecosystem? Would you kind of agree with that analogy?
Yeah, we actually see some of the infrastructure, if you think even lower than that, the actual, how well does this thing compute? How much data can it store? What is the networking throughput? We're getting to the point now where Urbit is on par or close to par with what you would expect from a Web2 experience. So we think from an architecture and an infrastructure perspective, lower than just tool building or things like that, that we're getting really close. And if Urbit is something like a new internet where there's peer-to-peer interactions instead of client-server interactions, what we're looking for is what's going to be that Netscape moment? What's going to be that first application that really clicks with customers? The way we think about Urbit as being something like Urbit Inside or Linux, a similar adoption to Linux in the sense that the customers that are being served here might not actually know that it's Urbit that's running all of this thing. They just might have a very similar web experience like they've always had. It does some particular thing for them that they couldn't normally do otherwise, and it just sort of works. That's really what we're looking for in terms of who are the entrepreneurs that are thinking in this way? What are they thinking about in terms of bringing to market? How are they solving problems? And what is their prospects either long-term? And we very much think this is a new sort of economy, very much tied into the crypto ecosystem as well. We think in terms of headless protocols. We think in terms of probably token economics. We think these are the ways in which the economic bandwidth is going to come online more and more than just consensus, which is very important. That's what blockchain allows us to do, these backends. But there's a whole lot of other stuff that needs to come along with that. And you need a full computer to execute all of that computation from the front ends, user data, identity, all of these things. We're looking for companies that need Urbit for some reason. They want to get to their customers and they just want to ship really good, really well-designed products. And they don't really necessarily know that it's going to be Urbit. In a similar way that Linux sort of drives all of the servers on the internet, it drives half of the mobile phone market. But for example, we never got a Linux desktop. So we don't necessarily think people are going to know that they're using Urbit, but they probably will if this infrastructure is really what we think it is.
Unlike a blockchain, Urbit does not have a token. Is that right?
No, it doesn't have a fungible token now. It doesn't have a notion of sort of native consensus, but there are projects that are thinking in this way. We're sort of agnostic on the back end, so to speak. Lots of different protocols or frameworks need additional augmentation in order to do networking, for example, or to run applications or front ends or make the user experience like a full stack as opposed to just a backend. And Urbit is somewhat agnostic about where the consensus is happening. It is important because otherwise in the Urbit context, there is no notion of global consensus. There's certainly a notion of individual consensus. Urbit runs in a similar way to a blockchain, meaning it's deterministic, it's transaction-based, it's one stacked up on it to the next, which actually defines what the state of your computer is. You can kind of think about it like a personal blockchain that interacts with other people's inter-blockchains, but that's not going to give you global consensus. But because it's a server, it can connect right over to those things, but we don't necessarily care too much about what that is.
I've heard of venture funds also owning some of these galaxies within their funds. I guess the only reason one would do that is if you think those are worth more in the future, if you're an investment fund anyways. Maybe you can explain that a little. I don't know if Octu is investing in those or solely the folks building around it, but curious about that. And then maybe you can also speak to a couple examples of things you guys have invested in or that the DAO has invested in, just to help us make it more tangible in terms of what these look like.
We don't invest in Urbit address space. We're big holders of Urbit address space. We think it will certainly increase in value as the network grows and as specific use cases kind of imbue that address space with reputation and value and trust. But we think that the really key opportunities here are stiffly in funding teams that build these tools and build these next level technical primitives that can spur adoption, again, as Kenny said, for specific use cases that solve business problems and product problems and coordination problems right away. We're certainly interested in people that do creative things with that distribution of address space. And certainly the address space distribution is one of the undersung aspects of Urbit. The galaxies are pretty widely distributed already. You go to Urbit Assembly, you meet some very interesting people that own an Urbit galaxy or own a bunch of stars. I do think there's a lot of latent social energy waiting to be unlocked on that level. And I'd love to see creative pitches around that. We think that really the alpha here, especially in terms of the deal flow and the ability to see different opportunities on behalf of our 35 and growing members, is very much on the building things on top of it right now.
Can you guys give, if you're able to anyways, example of something that the DAO has invested in that you think is interesting?
Part of our thesis is we've spoke about those three core components, the execution layer or the virtual machine and the network and then the ID space. These can be sort of broken up into different components. So we're not entirely focused on applications or companies that need to use the entire Urbit stack. So if there's one part that's like a meaningful connection, then that's also something we're interested in. And so one example of that is Zorp. And they've been building something called Knockchain, which essentially their goal is to make zero knowledge proofs and zero knowledge computing as cheap and as ubiquitous as tap water. If we want to have a high trust environment online, such that we can trust what we're actually seeing, or at least know where it came from, is probably a better way of thinking about it, and have some assurances that the things that we're using were run correctly, we're going to need these things to be a lot cheaper. But it just so happens that the instruction set, or the very core of the Urbit stack, the virtual machine, lends itself very well to zero knowledge computation. So that's the part that they took. They took that part and then they developed their own layer one, which then tries to incentivize provers to come in and actually prove zero knowledge proofs and make them as ubiquitous and as abundant as tap water. They're using one part of the very lowest stack. In this example, they're not using the Urbit operating system. They're not using the networking protocol, but they do have one part that they need in order to make their vision of zero knowledge proofs come into reality. That's one example of something we find very exciting. Another one is a company called Alphabet, and they're our prediction market company. And typically what happens with the prediction markets is they're, again, hosted on a central server. There's a single point of contact and a single point of failure when it comes to how these markets operate. And Alphabet is taking the notion that these should almost be like data objects. There's a protocol by which anybody could spin up one of these markets, get some sort of actionable intelligence from what a prediction market actually is. The way they're thinking about this is almost like a hub and spoke model. So you'd have an Urbit ID that can host a particular market and that hosts can make it available to other people who want to participate in it. And then they can share that out either through traditional social media channels or in private networks, however the distribution channel works best. And then that you can peer-to-peer participate in these markets. So they're not holding any customer data. They're not running any servers. They're not making any markets, but they're allowing other people to create these markets and making it very accessible. They're thinking of very much a Web 2 interface of a traditional way of interacting with the website. It feels just like a website, but it's actually you betting with your friends or whatever context you might need a prediction market in order to get actual intelligence or just to make a bet with friends, that sort of thing.
Those are great examples. I appreciate that. Urbit itself has been around for a long time. It's not a new thing. It does seem like it's really started to gain a lot of traction maybe over the past year or so in a way that it hasn't historically. If you look at the number of developers building around Urbit and the startup activity, it seems like the growth has been very strong. Why do you think that's changed over the past year? Has anything happened to spur that? Why are folks more recently suddenly much more interested to build around this ecosystem, if there is any reason in particular?
There's two things that immediately come to mind there. One is just that this is a very long-running technical project, as you mentioned, but it's really a very ambitious one. It had a long lead time because it was literally building a lot of these primitives from scratch. A lot of what we see in terms of growth, it's not like maybe some other projects where it's more this up and down. Are you going to attract the developers? Are you going to kind of like make an impact in this particular market? It's more that this organic progress got up to a point where all of a sudden there's a lot more service area for people to build on, and there's a lot more stability in both the computational stack and the network. And the Urbit Foundation has been shipping updates steadily. I mean, when I joined the company, it was a couple months before we actually launched a GUI interface that had any kind of UX whatsoever. Yet the project had already been running for probably about 17 years at that point from the very beginnings of the building the instruction set. So there's that aspect. And I'd say the other aspect is that the crypto ecosystem in general has gotten to a place of maturity where people realize that there's a need to replace these deep civilizational primitives that previously existed in an offline legacy form that are really decaying. And this goes to everything from credit bureaus to the legacy ID stack. What does my driver's license mean? What does my online identity mean? To obviously crypto economics. If you really have to replace the entire stack from the get-go, in some ways, it's better to replace 100% of it than 95% of it and still have a few lagging legacy dependencies. And Urbit as a complete computational stack, a complete network, a complete ID stack, really gives you the flexibility to build these things, to build the application as a data object, to build the platform economy as a protocol. And I think there's a lot of appetite now realizing just how far some of these legacy systems have degraded, and that we have a bunch of crypto economic rails and we have a bunch of crypto coordination rails, and we need a computational layer and a networking layer to knit that together to make it much more resilient for the next 100 years, 1,000 years of civilization. And we really do think about this project and this overall mission in those terms.
Within the Urbit ecosystem, from like a funding perspective, obviously you guys are out there, the DAO, I should say, is out there looking at projects. Where are Urbit-related projects raising capital from? Is it mostly crypto VCs, traditional VCs, Urbit people? Where's the capital interest coming from that you're seeing in the ecosystem?
Yeah, it's a little bit of all of this, but I would say it's probably more on the crypto side of things, especially more recently, though in the beginning there, for example, Assembly Capital was the largest funder in the Urbit ecosystem, and they could be thought of as more of a traditional venture fund. But more recently, so with Nochain, which is the Zorp, they had a couple crypto VC type funding mechanisms there, as well as individual angels within the ecosystem and other potentially even crowdfunding sort of efforts. We've seen a project that's interested in creating something like a, almost like a Kickstarter, but inside Urbit to get some of these things off the ground. It's a mix, certainly. And we see projects getting funded that are really thinking about probably, I would say, crypto economics first, token ideas of making a business and capturing value. Though there's certainly equity plays as well. So that might be more interesting to a traditional venture firm where they're going to try to create a product and accrue value in some other way besides using crypto economics. But I'd say probably most, if not all, are probably crypto related or crypto adjacent funds, as well as a handful of other funders as well.
Well, technically a DAO, you effectively act as a venture firm. You're competing to win allocation for early stage startups around this ecosystem. And how competitive is it to invest in really interesting startups. People aren't aware of Urbit as SaaS and crypto broadly. So is there a lot of competition, and how do you position Octu as a desirable source of capital, and how do you win deals and convince founders to take Octu's capital versus other capital sources?
I say it depends. Zorp, for example, was oversubscribed, and that was a competitive process. So there we had direct connections with the founder. Our structure lends itself that our network is pretty extensive. So we have personal connections a lot of the time with these early stage founders. And that's usually how we're going to get in with that allocation. In other ways, we're bringing expertise that is not available in other places as well. So that gives us an advantage. But we're also really looking for early seed rounds. In some cases, we're even helping to incubate a project. So if there is a founder that needs additional technical support in order to actually get that MVP out the door, we want Octu to be able to do incubation work like that. So in that case, we'd be the almost part of the team itself in an incubation sense. It really does range. So sometimes there is additional competition in which Octu has got to leverage its own existing network and what it can bring to the table in order to earn allocation. And in the other way, we're so early that there's less competition and that we can get the benefit of a more preferable evaluation or better place on the cap table.
We haven't really covered the incubation side, but just to flesh that out a little. So Octu is incubating projects. Curious how that works. Are you helping to ideate that? Does Octu get more ownership as a result of that? Maybe you can just give a little color on how that works.
So we have scheduled to do one or two incubations a year. They do tend to be rather labor intensive. There's a lot of potential there because there's a lot of devs and more recently a lot of entrepreneurs that come into the ecosystem and they have an idea and they maybe need a little bit of handholding to figure out how to make it work inside Urbit. And they also maybe need some help in terms of what the partnerships could be. And there really are things about the Urbit structure that are genuinely different. SaaS looks very different when you don't have the moat of the capital and then the infrastructure and then the talent around running a platform business. And so in my opinion, it becomes a lot more about what's your early network effect, what are your unique data sources, and what's your product differentiation, honestly. Within that context, I think we're able to help some of these founders, potential founders, look at how does this work inside Urbit. Both Kenny and I and just the membership in general have longstanding experience, not only actually navigating the Urbit ecosystem, but just thinking about how this develops ever since the early days when there were 400 people in the nascent GUI app the first time on the network. We're looking at one right now, and we definitely see this as a core part of Octu in terms of putting these pieces together because we are still so early. This is an ecosystem that's definitely taking off. There's an analogy that Urbit is address space, that it's land, it's Mars, it's a new world to explore. And I think that generally holds true in the sense that there's really a lot of stuff you can build here. And so guiding potential founders to a new part of that map and helping them figure out exactly what they can build is going to be really valuable for a long time.
The incubations are really work intensive, but also can be very lucrative often. Is the goal for all of that hard work you have to put into it, you either get to invest it at preferential terms or you get some sort of basically ownership for that work as part of the initial team?
That's right. We'll get an outsized allocation for sure for all of that effort. And one thing we haven't talked about in terms of our DAO structure itself is we have a core membership that's required to make investment decisions. So this is like the voting aspect of how we make decisions and how members actually participate. That's like the bare minimum. But then there's like a lot of other things that need to get done in order to run this organization correctly. And one of those things is going to be incubation work. We're going to have incentives for folks that are in the DAO that do additional work. And so they'll be compensated with additional, basically DAO shares.
I would love to pivot over and probably spend the rest of the time on the investment DAO side of it and how all that works. To start, you could just help us to understand what are the key differences between doing this as an investment DAO versus a traditional GPLP structure? And maybe as part of that, why did you guys choose to do this as an investment DAO versus going the more traditional route?
So essentially what we actually are is an LLC based in Delaware. And so all of our members are actually members of that LLC. And we are a for-profit investment. That's what we're doing as the company, the legal entity. And as long as we do a couple things, then it gives us some advantages. So as long as we are under 99 members, then we're not considered an investment company. So that's kind of our hard cap on our membership. And we actually also want to make sure we're meaningfully and accurately sort of decentralized from a control perspective. So no member can own more than 10%. And that's like a meaningful threshold of ownership. And so as long as we do that, you can easily see that we're member run and that no individual is actually in control of the organization itself. And as long as the members are actually running the group, this is like a private club in the sense of it's our responsibility to make this thing successful. And we're running it to the best of our ability such that we can actually make a profit and we can invest our resources accurately and the best way that we can. You can kind of actually think about it like a book club, but for money. This is not unusual. There's a structure for this in the United States specifically, such that if you do all of those things, then you can have a nice little regulatory little corner to play in. One of the interesting things that that affords us is that when it comes to accreditation, typically, if an individual wants to participate in a venture fund, they need to be an accredited investor. And there's lots of different ways that a person can be accredited, but typically what it means is you're a high net worth individual. You have significant financial resources, and that's what gives you the accreditation. But there's also another kind of accreditation, which is called a knowledgeable employee. This is the part of the regulation where like early startup employees can invest in the startup itself. This is where this regulation came from. Because we are this private member-driven LLC, we can onboard folks that aren't high net worth individuals. We can onboard engineers. We can onboard founders, these kinds of people. And that gets us why this structure specifically is really advantageous to a really early nascent ecosystem where the network really matters, where expertise really matters, and collective intelligence when it comes to due diligence really matters. So with all that, that's the structure that I think is going to win out in some of these early ecosystems, whether it be, you know, in Cosmos or Near or Solana, any of these places where you really do need sort of deep technical and understanding of the landscape in order to be successful. I think these models are going to proliferate. And we're kind of seeing this throughout the internet now with things like Hydra Ventures, example, where Hydra is a DAO that funds other investment DAOs, which is also where we got our start. So we're very thankful that these things exist. And we do think that it actually offers a competitive advantage.
I think you said you have a membership of 35 and growing, but at least at this moment in time, 35 members. Having a group like Octu where you have 35 folks who are deeply passionate about, and many have been deep in the urban ecosystem for a long time, as a founder, being able to access that pool of talent and human capital would be a very powerful story, is difficult, I guess, for like a traditional fund to replicate that maybe has, as a small fund, maybe one or two partners and can't really afford much of a team.
Exactly.
Makes a ton of sense. And I guess to that point, like, how do you think about building the membership? Because you have to raise money for the DAO. The DAO needs capital to deploy, but you also want to do so in a way where the members are valuable and are those types of folks that will provide more clout for Octu and bring deal flow and be valuable members in terms of doing diligence and post-investment work and all the usual things. How do you think about building the membership base as a DAO?
What I said earlier about Hydra is a really actually key component of that. There are other people in this ecosystem that are building. There's previous examples like Metacartel Ventures or the Lao, which have gone before us. They can help us get there. And so we think about building members in the sense of, so we have support from this other organization, which has its own distinct network. We go into those networks and we find those places where people are really interested in new and different ways of creating value and deploying capital. We find our way through the connections and the network that we've already got. And then we are also really interested in the ecosystem itself and who is building here and where is the talent located. And I think we've done really good in terms of recruiting there, but there's still always places to go and people to find. But I do really think the member-driven organization for these particular kinds of opportunities is essentially really valuable and likely to return well.
And I guess just thinking about the DAO investment process. So thinking through this, any member of the DAO can source deals. So you have kind of this large group of people that can source. How does it work from a diligence perspective? Smaller team, maybe volunteers to do diligence, and then you vote as a group. So you do diligence on an investment. And then it goes up to like a group of members and it basically passes or does not pass. I think you said based on capital weighted votes. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a stake weighted vote. And we use off the shelf tools to do this, like Snapshot, for example. But the way it would work is it is voluntary. So there'll be probably, like you said, maybe a deal lead or somebody that brings the opportunity to the group. And they might be the one responsible for sort of like a single point of contact with the potential investment in the group itself so that we can keep things tractable in that sense. And then we have regularly check-ins, all-hand meetings, where we talk about what are the opportunities that we're seeing and what things might we want to move forward with. And there's soft polling or directional. Yeah, that's something we want to get into. And then we'll raise our hands. Yes, who would want to go and do a more deep dive into a particular opportunity? Write that up such that the rest of the members have like a little one-page brief that they can review, ask any questions, any kind of follow-up on that. If it's like, yep, this is something we want to do, then it goes to all the members for a vote. And if that vote is actually approved, then we move forward with the investment. And then the LLC, the organization, is the thing that actually takes the ownership of whatever it is that we're purchasing, either at equity or future tokens or whatever the investment might be is owned collectively.
So one of the things that I think is really cool about Octu and is consistent with the Hydra model that you were describing is Octu doesn't take a management fee or carry like a traditional fund. Instead, it allocates a portion of the shares, correct me if I'm wrong in any of this, but to be earned over time through active participation by members. So it seems like that would be a great motivation to keep folks active, to keep them financially incentivized in the success of Octu beyond just their capital investment, to earn more ownership through being a valuable member. Can you speak to that a little in practice and why you guys like that model? And you guys are still pretty young as a DAO, so this hasn't been playing out for many years, but how you're seeing that dynamic play out as a DAO in real time would be curious.
You can kind of think about this as sweat equity too. That's a similar analogy. There's a lot of things that need to get done in order for an organization to run successfully. So there's operations, there's note-taking, there's deal sourcing, there's all of those little things. And it can be a lot of work. And so in order to make sure that all of those things are getting done and they're getting done well, we need some way in order to incentivize that. The model that we've landed on is that we've got, you can think of it like an inflation schedule. And for us specifically, you know, this is going to be different for every DAO. We thought, I think 20%, that's a number we feel comfortable with, that we can set those shares aside and that we can allocate them on some regular basis, maybe quarterly or bi-yearly, something like that, to the folks that are actually doing the work. And that also aligns incentives in the sense of it's not cash immediately right now. You do have to like think about this in a little bit longer term perspective, because it does take a while for investments to mature, usually in the order of several years or so. But that's the way we want to align membership. That's the way we want to incentivize going above and beyond what the normal requirements are for membership. And so far, this seems to be a good way to do that.
You guys, as we alluded to, worked with Hydra to get things going. Technically, you could just start your own investment DAO. You don't need Hydra per se to start an investment DAO. There's lots of other investment DAOs out there. Why partner with Hydra and go through that with them?
So Nick and I, we know Urbit really well. We know the space. We know Urbit inside and out. We don't know exactly what all the other components are. So we needed somebody to partner with us in order to actually really make this happen. And so Hydra has been invaluable when it comes to legal support, just advice. So we are still doing a lot of the work, but what work do we do? Some of that stuff we just really don't know. There's a lot of best practices when it comes to like drafting operating agreements, for example, or best practices when it comes to like these incentives. What's the best way to do that? And so we get fantastic advice from Hydra. We also get access to their network. So we get introductions that we normally would not get in other ways. It's really been invaluable. So my little advice to anybody that's been thinking along these lines of, I've got this ecosystem that I know really well. I know where the opportunities are. I have a lot of support, but I don't know exactly all the little pieces to help me get there. Groups like Hydra really can fill in the gap, as well as provide funding. Hydra was our first member, so they provided the first financial support that we ever had as well, which has also been invaluable. So highly recommend Hydra and any groups that are trying to create new investment DAOs where they didn't exist before.
I like it. We're getting short on time here. I guess two more quick questions, but one real question and one more personal question. If you run a normal fund, the GPs are full-time. That's their full-time job. Are you and Nick as summoners full-time on Octu? Obviously, you're not the GPs. You're just members of the DAO and you vote on deals and do the same stuff as everyone else. But is this a full-time thing for you or is it part-time given the DAO structure?
Feels pretty full-time right now. We're certainly very busy. There's a lot of interesting projects. Some of them are maybe investment stage and some of them just bear a lot of attention, keep an eye on. Obviously, there's getting the word out there. There's talking to our current members. We really try and stay in contact with all 35 members on a pretty close basis to see what they're seeing and read the room in terms of where they think opportunities might be, in terms of projects that are developing, et cetera. So yeah, it really feels like a full-time job. I mean, over time, once we fill out the fund, and this is more of keeping tabs on some of these projects, but I mean, I have a call scheduled with a founder that we've already invested in for next week to see, hey, like, what are some partnerships that we can help you with? It's an opportunity to get your message out there. So I foresee this being a pretty full-time commitment for quite a while.
Yeah, I kind of see it as ebbs and it flows. There are seasons in which there's a lot to be done, and there are seasons in which there's less. Certainly in the beginning stages, there's more effort and more work. We even think in this way in terms of incentives. We anticipate most of those incentives to be dished out in the earlier phases of things while we're still actively deploying that sort of thing. But from my previous experience, I was a member of MetaCartel Ventures as well, and it had a similar feel to it. There were times in which, especially in the beginning, when it felt like, yeah, this is a full-time thing. And then there are times 2 years in when it was not as much, so very much part-time. It is a bit of a mixed bag. It depends on where we are in the life cycle of any organization, but it is not our full-time job. We're not getting paid cash to do it, so to speak. We do other things to make ends meet.
So the most important question of all, if it was not for Urbit and tech and venture investing, what would you guys do for a living?
Tech has kind of been my thing since I was a little kid. But my other love is the outdoors. I live in the Pacific Northwest. I love getting outside. If I couldn't be in tech, I think I would have some sort of outdoor business, guiding or adventuring in some other way. That's also why I like tech. There's a lot of similar features to exploring and building beautiful things. I don't know. I'd be a river guide or a mountain climber or something like that.
I guess you have the internal adventure in the computers and the external adventure in the outdoors. I like it. How about yourself, Nick?
I think the thing that got me into tech in the first place was really thinking about its role in history. As a kid, I always planned to become a historian of some kind. The job market for historians is pretty awful in the usual academic sense these days. It's hard to imagine actually doing that these days, but I really have an abiding interest in tech history. I have some family connections. My grandfather worked in ENIAC. In fact, one of the things that got me into Urbit in the first place is just understanding that in some ways, this is kind of this branching, you know, path not taken of. There's a whole bunch of overlapping pile of cruft abstractions and decisions that were made that made the computing stack, made the internet more centralized than maybe we could have done if we had had some of these other options or if history had gone a different way. I actually think this is extremely important. I can't say this is a different decision in terms of my career because I feel like as an investor and as a community builder in Urbit, I'm continually thinking about the past, present, and future of how tech affects society. I find it kind of hard to parse out, but I have to say that it's extremely, extremely important to have that knowledge and to consider these questions all the time, again, as an investor and as someone looking at the current landscape.
I like it. If folks want to get a hold of you guys, chat Urbit or do some research on Octu Ventures, how can they find you and Octu online?
Yeah, we have a website. So octu.ventures has got a little bit more about us and some of the things that we're up to. We're also on Twitter. So that's Octu Ventures. And you can get a hold of us there. Of course, I'm SickDevPilnup on the network. So you can reach out to me directly on Urbit if you want to do that. And Nick, how about for you?
I'm Simfur Ritwed, SimfurRitwed.
Okay. Yeah, we'll have to put those in the show notes.
Exactly.
But yeah, sounds great. And yeah, thank you guys so much for joining us. Really appreciate Nick. Really appreciate Kenny. It's a fun conversation. So thank you.
Take care.
Cool. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Inside the Hut with your host, Brooke Pollock. You can find this and other episodes on any podcast player or at our website, www.hutcapital.com.